Good afternoon, Tri-States. This is IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. You are listening to your reader, Ken, reading from the Friday, April 2nd edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. We begin with our first piece from Above the Fold, and we start with a picture of a young lady in front of a spread out classroom, a small number of students, everyone is masked, and beneath it it says, Andrea Rundy, an English teacher at Hempstead High School, instructs her students during a Composition 1 class at a school in Dubuque on Tuesday, and the article is Joint Enrollment Options Popular with Local High School Students. About 3,000 high school students made up about half of the total enrollment at Northeast Iowa Community College last school year. Most of those students took college-level classes through arrangements between NICC and their school districts, along with a small number who paid to take courses independently via joint enrollment options offered by Iowa's community colleges. Our college is very committed to the high school partnerships that we have and to providing the opportunities to our students and the high schools, said Katie Gilbert, NICC's Dean of High School Partnerships. Joint enrollment accounted for 49.8% of NICC's total enrollment in the 2019-2020 school year, according to a recent report from the Iowa Department of Education. In many cases, those offerings have proven popular for local school districts, several of which saw at least 40% of their high school students jointly enroll last school year. Our goal is to have all students ready and prepared for the next level, so this is just another opportunity for us to help them launch into the next stage of their life, said Katie Leonard, a school counselor at Wallert Catholic High School in Dubuque. The number of Iowa students who were jointly enrolled increased by 2.4% from the 2018-2019 school year in the 2019-2020 school year, reaching a record 51,800 students, according to the Iowa Department of Education. At NICC, the number of jointly enrolled students dropped by 1.1%. Gilbert characterized student numbers as fairly stable in recent years. Obviously, we've had a little bit of declining enrollment at our high schools, but we tend to have been able to keep our enrollment stable at our partner schools, she said. At West Delaware High School in Manchester, 44% of high school students were enrolled in community college classes last school year. Principal Tim Felderman said he has seen steady numbers for concurrent enrollment classes offered at the high school, but the number of students in online classes offered through NICC is on the rise. They can work on these online classes as they have time to, Felderman said. They're just a lot more convenient for today's learner. In the Western Dubuque Community School District, 34.1% of high school students were enrolled in community college classes last year. Western Dubuque High School Principal Jacob Feldman said that doesn't capture the full spectrum of students taking higher-level classes, as educators have increased the number of available advanced placement courses. Still, the joint enrollment classes are a popular offering, Feldman said. Through those options, students have the chance to take courses in healthcare, math, engineering, computer science, and other subjects. It is a wide variety for any student that wants to take a higher level class from us, Feldman said. While high school students take joint enrollment classes in a variety of areas, a few subjects in particular seem to have the biggest draw. During the 2019-2020 school year, 26.6% of concurrent enrollment courses taken through NICC were in English, while 15.3% were in social sciences and history, and 10.2% were in healthcare sciences. At Wallert, the most popular joint enrollment offerings are statistics, composition classes, public speaking, and a course on cultural diversity and identity, Leonard said. The English classes in particular transfer well to various colleges and are good options to build college readiness. It's just a good option, and it's very cost-effective and a great way to get a jump start on some English credit for college, Leonard said. In Dubuque Community Schools, recently added and upcoming concurrent enrollment classes already are drawing student interest. A composition class offered for the first time this year already has 30 to 40 students signed up for the 2021-2022 school year, said Mark Burns, the district's executive director of secondary education. A public speaking class that will be offered for the first time next year already has 15 to 20 students signed up. Still, the most popular concurrent offerings in the district are courses that allow students to be trained as certified nursing assistants. About 70 students are signed up to take those courses next year, Burns said. Dubuque district leaders will keep expanding available concurrent classes next year, with U.S. history classes and an emergency medical technician course also being added to the roster. Officials are interested in adding math and science classes as they have qualified teachers and interested students, Burns said. It's about trying to get students a variety of different courses to apply what it is that they think they want to get into and learn a little bit more about themselves, he said. Now our second front page piece, City offering incentives for housing vouchers. City of Dubuque housing officials are testing new incentive programs to encourage landlords to accept tenants receiving government housing assistance. The four programs went into effect this week and will be piloted for 6 months. They provide funds to landlords who lease to people who receive federal housing choice vouchers or who hold units for those tenants, among other things. Officials in the city's Housing and Community Development Department decided to introduce the incentives after city council members declined to adopt an ordinance that would have required landlords to accept tenants who receive housing vouchers. A recent review by the city found that about 31.9% of rental units were owned or operated by landlords that accepted housing vouchers. The new incentive programs will be offered to owners or operators of units in census tracts identified as having relatively small acceptance rates. We're trying to address census tracts that specifically have a low acceptance rate, said Alexis Steger, Dubuque's Housing and Community Development Director. These incentives were shown by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development as effective methods of acceptance. The new incentives include a landlord signing bonus, which provides $1,000 to landlords who successfully lease to a housing choice voucher participant. A no-loss vacancy program reimburses landlords up to 1 month of rent for holding a vacant unit so a tenant receiving housing assistance can lease it. Both programs will be paid for using leftover funds from the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, Steger said. About $125,000 remains from the stimulus bill for housing assistance. Another incentive program, the Property Damage Reimbursement Fund, provides up to $2,500 for a landlord who accepts a housing voucher tenant and experiences damage to the leased unit. Jerry Morrow, president of Dubuque Area Landlords Association, said he is most excited about that incentive in particular. He said many landlords avoid accepting tenants who receive housing assistance, largely out of fear that the tenant will be unable to pay the costs for damaging a rental unit. When there was damage done by a voucher holder, there was no recourse for a landlord to collect on damages, Morrow said. This will make landlords feel more confident to accept housing vouchers, I think. Steger said the fund is entirely supported by Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque, which has donated $50,000 to the program. City officials also established an Energy Savers program, which provides funding to help landlords replace the water heater or furnace in units being leased by Housing Choice Voucher recipients if the appliance is determined to be energy inefficient. That program is also available to low and moderate income homeowners. Steger said the Energy Savers program will be paid for using federal Community Development Block Grant funds. The program will be reviewed in 6 months to determine their effectiveness, Steger said. Afterward, Housing and Community Development Department staff will decide whether to pursue continued funding for the programs. Now our final front page piece, Galena Mann's Legacy Dug Into Joe Davies County. It is hard to drive across Joe Davies County and not pass one of the thousands of residences and commercial structures that Tom Weenan helped build. From the cab of his excavator, he played in the dirt throughout his adult life, driven by the sense of accomplishment he derived while completing a job. If he could keep working, he'd still be here, said his son, Nick Weenan. Tom, 69, died in late February from pancreatic cancer, a disease with which he grappled for 2.5 years. Even while undergoing treatment, digging sustained him. Tom's career began in late childhood when he fell under the tutelage of his uncle Al Green, a construction worker. After graduating from Galena High School in 1969, Tom served overseas in the U.S. Army. He worked at Don Green Construction before starting an excavating and land development business with his brothers in 1975. They built many subdivisions, including Indian Ridge, Weenan Estates, and Gulfview Estates, Galena's Industrial Park, and the Galena Planned Unit Development. I don't think he ever realized what he accomplished because it was a day-to-day go-to-work thing, said his wife Connie Weenan, whom he married in 1977. They raised 2 children, Nick and Ben. The boys always had a dirt pile in the backyard on which they amused themselves, along with Legos, Lincoln Logs, and toy diggers. Construction sites became learning laboratories for Tom's sons, who entered the trade after completing high school and labored alongside Tom. It wasn't work, Ben said. It was just going and having fun with your family. Get the job done. Tom was a patient instructor, dispassionately explaining a procedure or machine. After working for Tom's brothers, Tom and his boys worked together for Ben's company, Ben Weenan Excavating and Landscaping. The three and Connie also operated a storage business. Tom did not gamble nor watch television, but he enjoyed dinner at Texas Roadhouse, where he would have a cold glass of Samuel Adams and a steak cooked medium well. At job sites, Tom shared his passion for construction by giving excavator rides to his grandkids and customers' children. Everyone wants to know how a machine works, Ben said. When he vacationed, Tom took opportunities to feed his hunger for knowledge. The mechanical underpinnings of machines and architecture fascinated him. He visited the Panama Canal and Hoover Dam. While on a Caribbean cruise, it would not be out of character for Tom to request a tour of the engine room. Doctors diagnosed Tom with cancer in 2018 after discovering a lesion on his pancreas. He underwent chemotherapy and surgery. He never complained, Ben said. He would get treatment, and when he would get home, he would call to know where we were at or where he could go to do something. The treatment appeared successful until the cancer returned the following year, prompting a second operation and more chemo. He didn't want to give up, Connie said. I think he always thought that something would work. The knowledge that Tom achieved his goals and spent time with those he loved makes the pain of his loss easier to bear, Connie said. His only regret was that he really wanted to take the kids and grandkids to Disney World, she said. We now continue with Inside and some Dubuque news. The Iowa's virus death toll surpasses 5,750. Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 3.5% as 38 more Dubuque County residents were confirmed to have COVID-19 during the 24-hour period. Other counties, including Clayton County with 1.5%, Delaware County 6.5%, Jackson County 5.2%, and Jones County 3.5% were the positivity rates there. The state provided new county-level hospitalization data on Thursday. As of Tuesday, 3 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized, an increase of 1 from Monday. Jones County had 1 such resident hospitalized, the same as Monday. Jackson County had 3 such residents hospitalized, an increase of 1 from Monday. No such residents of Clayton and Delaware counties were hospitalized. Officials at Regional Medical Center in Manchester announced that they are discontinuing their vaccine waiting list due to expanding eligibility in the state starting April 5th. Future vaccination appointments can be made online. Residents who need help registering can call Regional Family Health at 563-927-7777. Delaware County Public Health at 563-927-7551. Or Regional Medical Center, 563-927-7600. Statewide, the number of Iowa residents who have tested positive for COVID-19 grew by 801 in the 24-hour span, increasing the state's total to 351,803. 8 additional related deaths were reported, raising the death toll to 5,751. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, 616,065 Iowans had been fully vaccinated, an increase of 14,863 from Wednesday. In Wisconsin, the state reported 517 additional confirmed COVID-19 cases Thursday, increasing its total to 577,712. The state's death toll rose by 3 to 6,625. Wisconsin reported 1,076,380 residents have been fully vaccinated, or 18.5% of the population. Grant County health officials changed the way they report COVID-19 cases on Wednesday. Officials stopped reporting the number of recovered individuals and total confirmed positive individuals to date. The county continues to report daily positive rates, daily deaths, and total deaths. Iowa County has a new COVID-19 vaccine waiting list, and residents can register at bit.ly/3mkLHI. Crawford County health officials are taking appointments for vaccination clinics scheduled for 10 to 11:25 a.m. and noon to 12:55 p.m. Thursday, April 8th. Appointments can be scheduled at crawfordcountywi.org/health or by calling 608-326-0229. In Illinois, there were 1,248,111 COVID-19 cases as of 5 p.m. Thursday, a 24-hour increase of 3,526 cases. The state reported 25 more related deaths, increasing the death toll to 21,326. Illinois also reported 2,204,598 residents were fully vaccinated, 17.3% of the state's population. Joe Davies County health officials and the Illinois National Guard announced that there will be a mass vaccination clinic on Wednesday, April 7th at the River Ridge School District in Hanover. Anyone aged 18 and older who lives or works in the county is eligible to register. Registration will begin today at noon at bit.ly/3R8UR. Our next piece, groups urge expansion of ATV-UTV hours on Dubuque County roads. Local all-terrain and utility vehicle users are asking the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors to expand the hours in which riders are allowed on county roads. The Dubuque County ATV-UTV Alliance and the Northeast Iowa Action Trails Riding Club sent a request to the supervisors this week, asking them to allow riders to be out until 10 p.m. rather than sunset as currently required. Supervisors in 2019 approved the ordinance that allows ATVs and UTVs on most county roads from 5 a.m. to sunset, following many months of back and forth among supervisors, law enforcement, and groups of riders. NEAT President Ron Switzer said allowing users on roads until 10 p.m. would be closer to his group's initial wish. Now, if you're out deer or turkey hunting, you'd have to quit before your hunting time is up at the end of the day to get home, he said. Also, if people wanted to ride out to a restaurant for dinner, a lot of the time it's getting dark at 5:30 or 6 p.m. However, Supervisor Ann McDonough said there are reasons for the current times in which the vehicles are allowed on the road. For every person who thinks they should be able to ride whenever they want, there's another property owner who really relishes the quiet and peace, she said. In a social media post, the ATV-UTV Alliance pointed to nearby counties where riders can be on roads later than Dubuque County. The vehicles can be out until 10 p.m. in Jackson County and 11 p.m. in Clayton County. Clayton County Sheriff Mike Chickree said his department has never had problems with the later time, largely because few people ride late at night. At the time we set that, we knew most people are home or in bed at 10 p.m., he said. But you have farmers or raccoon hunters who might be out late. Generally, people aren't messing around. McDonough acknowledged that the patchwork of different county ordinances on ATVs and UTVs was confusing. With any ordinances we write, they don't match with adjoining counties in many, many respects, she said. And there's legislation pending down at the State House looking at taking away our ability to do anything. Eventually, the state probably is going to have to lead on this. A bill being considered in the Iowa legislature would allow registered ATVs and UTVs on county highways statewide and strikes counties' authority to regulate their use. Supervisor Jay Wickham said there would be a lot for supervisors to consider before making any change. From what I've heard from law enforcement, it's been a non-factor, he said. Supervisor McDonough voted against it. Supervisor Harley Potoff has been critical of the ordinance and has a lot of experience with patrol, so their input is going to be key. Potoff could not be reached for comment. Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy was on vacation this week and declined to comment. Now we turn to our opinion page and our view. Today's quick takes that reflect the consensus of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald editorial board. And today we have a mixed page of faces. Our first one is a frowny face. Beware of political candidates who won't share views. Tuesday is election day for residents of Wisconsin and Illinois, where ballots will include candidates running in municipal and school board races. Over the past 2 weeks, the Telegraph Herald has previewed key races in our coverage area, talking to dozens of candidates about their positions on local issues and goals for the future. Contenders let voters know about their past experience, what motivated them to run for public office, and their priorities if elected. It's key reading for informed voters. What's troubling is that in several area races, one or two candidates have declined to speak to a TH reporter. Reporters try calling and emailing and are sometimes rebuffed by candidates who refuse to speak to the media. That should tell voters something. If a candidate is unwilling to share his or her basic information and reasons for running for public office, how forthcoming with the public will that person be once elected? When a candidate says, "I don't listen to voicemails or answer calls if I don't know the number," how does that bode for a constituent trying to reach his or her elected representative? Elected officials are called upon to work collaboratively with all kinds of people and businesses. Is one who won't speak to the local paper likely to be someone who can easily collaborate with others? What about when it comes time to vote on a contentious issue? That's bound to happen in local government. Don't we expect our elected officials to explain why they voted the way they did? Voters might think twice about candidates who aren't willing to publicly state what they stand for. Our next piece is a smiley face. While there might be fewer tri-state area residents living on farms today, this area's agricultural roots are strong. Many, if not most, people from the area are just a generation or two removed from the farm. Plenty of locals grew up with a grandparent or aunt and uncle who lived on a farm. Today, fewer youngsters are getting that exposure to farm life and caring for animals. That's a trend that Mitch and Angie Payton decided to do something about. The Manchester couple built Legacy Cattle Company, a cow-calf barn south of Manchester on Iowa 13. The facility will offer kids a chance to raise and show cattle, learning the lessons taught in the show ring and the barn. Along with their own four children, the Paytons' facility will provide an opportunity for area kids, whether or not they have farming roots, to learn the basics of working with cattle. It's encouraging to see this young couple giving back to their community by providing an experience in agriculture for kids. As Mitch Payton said, "I believe there is a huge opportunity for young people to be involved in agriculture moving forward. If we can be a small catalyst for any of that, we will feel really good about what we are doing." And our third and final quick take is kind of a scrunched up face. Wisconsin is poised to get rid of an arcane law only a handful of states have on the books. Dodgeville Representative Todd Novak is working on eliminating the state's prohibition on remarriage for the first 6 months following a divorce. That's the right move. People get divorced. It isn't an easy thing to go through for most people, but it's a fact of life. State government need not insert itself into the personal decision of when it's been long enough to consider remarriage after divorce. Folks in Iowa, Illinois, and 41 other states managed to make that decision on their own without state lawmakers' help. Surely, Wisconsin residents can do the same. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken, and I'm reading from the Friday, April 2nd, 2021 edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we now turn to our obituaries. Lawrence G. Hafer, Cuba City. Lawrence Larry G. Hofer, 88, of Dubuque, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, passed away on Monday, March 29th, at UW-Madison Hospital in Madison. Funeral services will be held at 11:30 a.m. Monday, April 5th, at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Cuba City, with Father David Flanagan officiating. Burial with military honors accorded will be at St. Matthew's Cemetery in Shullsburg. Family and friends may call on Monday, April 5th, from 9:30 a.m. until the time of service at the church. Due to current state and health regulations, face masks and social distancing guidelines will be implemented. The Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City is serving the family. Larry was born February 4th, 1933, to Gottfried and Maybelle Baggs Hofer, Sr. in Shullsburg. He served in the U.S. Army Air Force during the Korean War. He married Darlene G. Bauer on July 13th, 1957, at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Cuba City. Larry worked in the area mines and later owned and operated Hofer's Cafe in Cuba City. He was a member of St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church and the VFW Post Number 8318 in Cuba City. Larry enjoyed fishing, cribbage, his tractor, lawnmower, watching the Green Bay Packers, old Western movies, loved his animals, but most of all, he enjoyed time spent telling stories with his family and friends. He will be sadly missed by all who knew and loved him. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Lawrence Larry G. Hofer Memorial Fund has been established. Memorials may be mailed to Howdenshield Funeral Home, care of Lawrence Hofer Family, Box 825, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.howdenshieldfuneralhome.com. And now we have our births. That was a short list of the obituaries. And our new arrivals, we have a short list there too. Wednesday, March 31st, DeWolf Ophium. Curtis DeWolf and Courtney Ophium of Dubuque, a girl at Unity Health Finley Hospital in Dubuque, and Kutch, Cody and Mackenzie Kutch of Dubuque, a boy at Finley. Welcome aboard, you little ones. We're glad to have you here. And now we'll turn to a few pieces of news in brief on this page. And our first one, special election set for April 20th to fill two vacant Garnavillo City Council seats. From Garnavillo. Two candidates are running for two Garnavillo City Council vacancies in a special election. Robert Bodish and Shelley Diedrich filed paperwork to run in the April 20th special election, which council members decided was the best way to fill the empty seats. Clayton County Deputy Auditor Amy Bonson confirmed that Bodish did resign from his council seat, though he is now running again. The other resignation came from Bonnie Diedrich. Voters were able to start mailing in absentee ballots or voting early in person on Wednesday, according to the Clayton County Auditor's website. The last day to vote absentee in person is April 19th. Polls for the special election will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. April 20th at Garnavillo Community Building, 106 West Niagara Street. All absentee ballots must be received by the auditor's office by 8 p.m. April 20th. Next, rent utility assistance available to Iowa residents impacted by COVID-19. Applications are being accepted for rent and utility assistance for qualifying Iowa residents. The Iowa Rent and Utility Assistance Program can help eligible renters impacted by COVID-19 with funds from the American Rescue Plan Act, according to a press release. It states that the funds can provide rent and utility bill assistance for renters who meet income qualifications, have qualified for unemployment during the COVID-19 pandemic, face homelessness, have experienced a reduction in household income, or have another financial hardship. The Iowa Homeowner Foreclosure Prevention Program can help income-eligible homeowners with mortgage assistance. Visit iowahousingrecovery.com or call 515-348-8813 or 855-300-5885 for more information, including application assistance. Additional information for Dubuque residents is available at cityofdubuque.org/COVID-19 support. And we have one more from this page. One hurt in two-vehicle crash in Dubuque. One person was hurt in a two-vehicle crash Tuesday in Dubuque. Kiana M. Floyd, 39, of Dubuque, was transported by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center for treatment, according to Dubuque Police. The crash occurred at about 3:35 p.m. Tuesday at the intersection of White and East 16th Streets. Police reported that an eastbound vehicle driven by Maurice Jones, 34, of Dubuque, and a westbound vehicle driven by Floyd were stopped at the stop signs on 16th Street at the intersection when Jones started turning onto White, striking Floyd's vehicle while it was proceeding through the intersection. Jones was cited with failure to yield upon making a left turn and driving with a suspended license. Now we'll turn back to some of our tri-state news. Ertl, now a part of Tomy, T-O-M-Y, touts 75 years in toy business from Dyersville. An iconic Dyersville company recently reached a milestone anniversary as Ertl, now a part of Tomy, celebrated 75 years in the toy business. It was 1945 when Fred Ertl Sr. began making scale models of farm tractors in his basement in Dubuque. What started as a hobby soon led to the Ertl Company that produced toy tractors and farm implements that have become known worldwide. Fred Ertl Sr. immigrated to the United States from Germany, landed in the Dubuque area, and worked there as a journeyman mold maker, explained Ertl historian and senior vice president of marketing Bill Walters. When World War II ended in 1945, the government stopped lots of contracts, and there were labor issues around the country. Fred Ertl Sr. ended up without a job. He tried to figure out what he could do to support his family and wanted to make some toys for his kids. He ended up finding some scrap aluminum and made some sand cast molds. He melted that aluminum in the furnace in his basement and started making toy tractors. From those humble beginnings, Ertl's toys soon became well known in the area, and his scale model tractors were selling out as quickly as he could produce them. He took them to a local store in Dubuque, and they said, "We'd love to sell them. How many can you make?" And so he started selling them around the area, said Walters. He would take toy tractors around in the trunk of his car and sell them to various retailers. Then, in 1946, he got in contact with a gentleman at John Deere and was able to get the John Deere license. From there, they just started getting bigger into it. Ertl continued to expand, renting space in Dubuque and adding on several times before deciding a larger location was needed and moving its operations to Dyersville. They built their first facility in Dyersville in 1959. The original building is south of Tyson's or behind the Casey's, Walters said. Obviously, the company kept expanding and needed more space, so that's when they built the building south of Highway 20, which is essentially where all the offices are. That's also our main warehouse facility now, but back in the day, that was our manufacturing center. The company grew significantly in the early years, expanding its footprint in the industry. We were able to get additional licenses. In 1955, we got what at that time was International Harvester. We got a Case license and a Ford license, pretty much all the major tractor manufacturers. Alice Chalmers was one at the time as well, said Walters. We were producing quite a range. Tomy, based in Japan, has been the parent company of Ertl since 2011. The current Dyersville facility is the North American Distribution Center for the company. Pretty much everything we bring in for the John Deere dealerships, the Case IH dealerships, or the farm stores goes through here, Walters said. Walmart, Target, you name it, it comes through Dyersville. Ertl's 75th anniversary fell in October, but with COVID-19 impacting every aspect of life, the celebration was postponed. Thanks to a manufacturer's showcase exhibit at National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville, visitors can still experience Ertl's 75 years. The museum will sponsor its annual Summer Farm Toy Show on June 5 and 6. Walters, who has been with Ertl since 1993, is a member of the museum's 2020 Hall of Fame class. Farm toys are just toys to some people, but they're more than that to others. If you think about it, you're kind of preserving history, said Walters. These tractors that were made 100 years ago, nobody uses them anymore, but you can still look at them from a toy aspect. Officials confirm 4 Southwest Wisconsin historic sites to stay closed this year. Officials recently confirmed that 4 historical sites in Southwest Wisconsin will remain closed this year as the agency that oversees them deals with budget cuts and pandemic-related revenue shortfalls. The Wisconsin Historical Society announced its intent to follow through with plans to temporarily pause service at First Capital in Belmont, Pendarvis in Mineral Point, Stonefield in Cassville, and Villa Louie in Prairie du Chien. In all, 8 attractions across the state will not reopen until 2022, with the others being H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum, Madeline Island Museum, Reed School, and Wade House Historic Site. The Historical Society was tasked with whittling more than $1 million from its budget for the fiscal year that runs through June. Adding to its challenges was the anticipated loss of $2.5 million in operations revenue stemming from site closures last year. To avoid staff layoffs, more than 50 society employees have been reassigned to the state's administration, health, and workforce departments to assist in pandemic response efforts. Unfortunately, we know that this is a huge impact to you and our communities, so we are doing what we can to use this year as wisely as possible, wrote Susan Kaya Schlusser, Regional Director of Southwest Sites for Wisconsin Historical Society, in a letter. While we will not open for tours, we are staying very busy with many huge projects in the works. We are also preparing for the 2022 season, writing business and staffing plans to address the unique challenge of reopening after 2 very uncertain years. The letter then provides updates on projects being tackled at the 4 local sites, including the clearing of massive amounts of brush from the Mine Hill at Pendarvis in order to expand trails and uncover and preserve historic landscape features. Continued work on new interpretive panels for the kiosk at First Capital. Work on a walkway project and repairs related to the 2019 flood at properties at Villa Louie. And major repairs at the schoolhouse at Stonefield. UWP's planned solar array attracts state star power from Platteville. Wisconsin's lieutenant governor said he was encouraged by the student drive that spurred the development of a $3.4 million solar array, the construction of which will begin at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville in the coming months. Mandela Barnes visited the site Thursday for a showcase of the institution's sustainability initiatives and an additional building project. Projects like what is going on here show how we can take a sustainable lead in terms of the way buildings can be built, he said. There are still so many opportunities. The 2.4 megawatt solar array will be located on a 5-acre hill in Memorial Park and will generate enough power to satisfy 17% of UWP's electrical needs. It represents the largest solar installation owned by a Wisconsin state agency. Amy Seaboth Wilson, UWP Sustainability Coordinator, said the university-owned and maintained array will pay for itself within 16 years, saving UWP $217,000 annually and reducing carbon dioxide emissions by 2,300 metric tons. Barnes chairs the Governor's Task Force on Climate Change, which released a report in December. It contains 55 recommendations to help the state adapt to the effects of global warming, including investment in community solar projects. UWP's array was spearheaded by an ad hoc committee of students who organized in 2018. Those are the students that are going into the chancellor's office, that are going around and petitioning, that are talking about these projects, Junior Ryan Lodico said. But equally important are the students who are listening. The project found widespread support across campus. A 2019 referendum indicated that 82% of UWP students want the campus to fully transition to renewable energy. About 70% of respondents said they would be willing to contribute $10 or more annually in support of that effort. Lodico said students also are pushing the university to eliminate campus waste. Such initiatives are challenged by a lack of comparable examples at similarly sized institutions of higher education, he said. We're kind of breaking into uncharted territory with both of these projects, Lodico said.
We have to explore the practical options that we have. State Representative Travis Tranel, Republican, Cuba City, said he appreciates the thoughts that went into the array's planning and its siting on unused grounds. One of the complaints I often hear is that we shouldn't be doing this on prime agricultural farmland, he said. During his visit, Barnes also toured Bobel Hall, a campus science facility that is undergoing a $24 million renovation and is due to be sustainably completed this summer.
Now we'll see what's happening this weekend. We have our weekend buzz, things to do in the tri-state area. And we have the Shellsburg Easter Egg Hunt Saturday, Badger Park in Shellsburg. 10 a.m., the free egg hunt is open to children in fourth grade and younger, as long as they are accompanied by an adult. Easter Bunny will be on hand, and all participants get a treat and a chance to win one of four youth bikes. Non-perishable items will be collected for the food pantry. Social distancing and masks are required. Commercial Club Park and Events Center Annual Easter Egg Hunt. Saturday, Commercial Club Park, Dyersville. The free egg hunt starts at 1 p.m., but everybody should check in at least 15 minutes early at the registration booth to find out where each group is located. Children will be grouped in ages 1 to 3, 4 to 6, and 7 to 9. In addition to eggs and candy, two golden tickets for Easter baskets will be hidden for each group. Easter Bunny will also be in attendance. Tri-State Farmers Exchange, Saturday, Dubuque County Fairgrounds, at 7 a.m. to last vendor closure, approximately 2 p.m. Enjoy the day supporting local farmers, buy, sell, or trade. No setup fees. Cost $5 for anyone older than 12. Ages 12 and younger, admitted for free. This next piece comes from our lifestyle page. I don't often read from this one, but this is a Dubuque Icon event that will be occurring. And the article reads, "They're back!" The Julian Dubuque International Film Festival was on a roll in 2020. Executive Director Susan Gorell and her team had taken the annual event and festival from a small regional event to an internationally recognized and industry-respected celebration of independent film and filmmakers. Then COVID-19 arrived, and the momentum stopped, at least temporarily. "Yes, the festival was virtual last year," Gorell said. "Personally, I understand why we had to do it for the safety of everybody. I get that. I was sad because filmmakers had such a rough year." The annual fundraising gala, usually a fete of film and food, also had to go virtual in February. Attendees received a link so they could watch from home and were treated to a delivered platter of appetizers from Caroline's restaurant, along with a swag bag of film-related goodies. "Nothing is the same over Zoom. You can't beat in person," Gorell said. "We did try to make it different. A lot of organizations do this kind of thing live and do a lot more talking. What made the festival gala different were the trailers and testimonials. People really wanted to see the trailers, and the testimonials were wonderful, seeing what filmmakers have to say and what they love about Dubuque. There's a little more passion and excitement that comes with a film festival in general, so I wanted to make sure that came across." From a virtual perspective, Gorell considered last year's festival and the gala successes. The 2020 festival saw 60% of the accepted films opting to participate on a virtual platform and with a bigger virtual audience than she expected. However, Gorell said it was disappointing for many of the filmmakers. "Some of them couldn't participate because it could affect their distribution ability later on, or it just wasn't something they wanted or could do for whatever reason," she said. Gorell invited all the accepted films from last year to return in 2021 for the festival's 10th year. Slated for Sunday, April 18th through Sunday, April 25th, the festival has been expanded to 8 days to accommodate the screening of additional films.
Comedian Rel Battle, who hosted the virtual gala, will come to Dubuque to help celebrate the festival's 10th anniversary. I wanted to do it for the filmmakers so that those from 2020 actually had an opportunity to experience the festival in person, she said. And I wanted to do it for the attendees because they missed out last year. While many of last year's filmmakers have moved on or were unable to return because of distribution deals, attendees will get the opportunity to see some of last year's accepted films, along with this year's crop of full-length and short features and documentaries. The Cave, which will be the international film shown on Thursday, April 22nd, is an action drama film from Thailand about the 2018 cave rescue of the Thai soccer team. The film features some of the divers portraying themselves. The family feature film, Saving Paradise, will have its world premiere at the festival. Based on true events, the film tells the story of a corporate raider who returns to his hometown after inheriting a failing pencil factory. The Girl Who Wore Freedom, a feature documentary that tells the stories of French citizens during the invasion of Normandy, will feature a reenactment component in Washington Square. Local filmmakers have made the cut, too, including documentary short One Stolen Moment, feature short Auditor, and feature-length documentary The Final 19. To me, it's a testament to the filmmaking in Iowa getting better, and that's good to see, Gorel said. We don't choose a film just because it's from Iowa. They have to go through the process just like anybody else. These films made it on their own merits. Of more than 800 applications, only about 130 films were accepted into this year's festival. We take about 15% of the films that apply, Gorel said. In addition to attending film screenings, attendees will have the opportunity to participate in workshops and question and answer sessions and attend events including networking gatherings and an awards night celebration the final day of the festival. The importance of the festival among industry professionals has grown exponentially during its 10-year existence. Gorel said much of that has to do with the festival's mission to impact not only the film industry, but also the community. There are thousands of film festivals around the world, many of them small community festivals, she said. There's nothing wrong with that, but I was always big on the community impact. Gorel said filmmakers who traveled to Dubuque for the festival always are impressed with the city as a cultural destination, and how the festival not only celebrates the films and filmmakers, but also showcases and benefits the host community. Dubuque is very artsy, and what the festival brings financially and culturally is huge, she said. The board has been very progressive in its artistic thinking and on the impact financially, culturally, and educationally that this festival has on the community. This brings us to the end of today's reading from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Friday, April 2nd, remembering that this is brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. I wish you a wonderful weekend ahead. The weather promises to bring us some warm and balmy temperatures, so perhaps get out, take in some fresh air, take a walk, and let the warm sunshine fall upon you. Until next week, take care.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.